you're sitting there like, why the hell am I talking and praising this kid when I feel like I should be the one playing right now on that level? When I was younger, the way I would deal with confrontation, I would want to fight, right? So imagine that, trying to be on air and somebody corrects you and not even being apologetic about it. Like, I would walk off the set with my hands clenched, like, I want to knock Doug Gottlieb to blank out. I have forgiven myself, but I haven't forgot. And I don't think I will ever forget, nor do I want to forget, because I think that accident still serves into my motivation to this day.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview an interesting member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Bette Marston. And today my guest is the ESPN college basketball analyst, Jay Williams, who has he's written a memoir, and that is out as we speak. It is called Life is Not an Accident, a memoir of reinvention. You can check that book out on Amazon, bookstores everywhere. I read it over the weekend. It's a pretty honest account of Jay's struggles after his motorcycle accident following his rookie year in Chicago, and him trying to find a place in the world after basketball was taken away. He talks very honestly about suicide attempts and getting, I would probably call it an addiction to OxyContin, and just struggling with self-identity, who he is, who he was, who he will be. And he is now a analyst on ESPN, and pretty much has landed a prominent role in their college basketball division, and continues to move up in broadcasting. So he's got an interesting backstory, and I'm looking forward to talking to him today. I think this can be a really interesting interview. All right, as promised, here is Jay Williams from, I think, somewhere in New York City today, the ESPN college basketball analyst and now a new author. Jay, thank you very much for joining us today on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me, man. Always been a big fan of yours, and appreciate the honesty that you always have in your interviews, and it's going
to
be fun.
I appreciate it. Try not to keep – don't say that too much to your bosses, Jay. I'd like you to stay employed.
I won't tell them. I'll keep it on low.
One of the things that was really interesting about – the book. I mean, there are a lot of things interesting about the book, and I would certainly recommend it. It's, and we'll get into how the process of how Jay wrote it, but it's a very honest account of his life. And one of the things that you were really honest about, Jay, was just how poor a broadcaster you were initially. And much of that was self-admittedly your own lack of preparation, not knowing what the business was about, maybe thinking sort of you could just come in on name only and being on the air. How would you view yourself as a broadcaster today versus when you entered the business a couple years ago?
Exponentially better. I would say that the one word to describe me maybe 5-6 years ago was shitty. And it was because, you know what, Richie? It was one of those things that, like all of us athletes, there's an ego that comes along with who we are, right? It's kind of made us into what we were able to accomplish. And at the time of my first go around being a broadcaster, I didn't really want to be a broadcaster. I wanted to play basketball, right? So when you're 25, 26, there was so much animosity that I had, you know, towards some of these guys that literally 4 years ago, I knew they were coming into school. And, you know, I played against in the AAU circuit and I had dominated back in high school. And you're sitting there like, why the hell am I talking and praising this kid when I feel like I should be the one playing right now on that level? And obviously, look, it's the wrong way of thinking, but I think that mentality really led me to not be prepared, right? And I was more into, well, you know, how can I potentially get my body back to maybe play? And just dealing with a whole range of emotions while going through it. And by the way, I was addicted to OxyContin. So, you know, just not calling a game, but not wanting to face people, right? And have them remind me of this one idiotic mistake that I made back when I was 21 that I knew was going to follow me for the rest of my life. And it was and working with Doug Gottlieb didn't make it easier, man. Doug is ruthless. He still is today, right? And I think now, being 34 years old, there's an appreciation I have for guys that take their job so seriously, because I think I try to prep in the same way. And I'm still trying to figure this whole thing out and still getting better at it and becoming more of who I am and being open about it. But it's, you know, Doug used to, if I had a fact wrong, Doug would make sure that the world knew I had a fact wrong on air and wasn't afraid to call me out. And, when I was younger, the way I would deal with confrontation, I would want to fight, right? So imagine that, trying to be on air and somebody corrects you and not even being apologetic about it. Like, I would walk off the set with my hands clenched, like, I want to knock Doug Gottlieb the blank out, right? And just learn how to, okay, figure out, like, all right, well, he's, you know, we're debating, but I can't take this debate seriously, right? I have to find this intellectual game. So it's been a process, but it's been one now that I actually enjoy more than ever, because it's like an intellectual chess game. Whereas before, I wanted to make it so physical and just ready to fight all the damn time.
That's interesting. There's a lot there that you just brought up, and we're going to get to all of them, but let's stick with the Gottlieb thing for a moment. I read that anecdote in the book, and it's very clear Doug is trying to show you up on the air. You wrote, he never hesitated to point out when I got a stat wrong or stumbled on a name, and that happened all too often. So a couple questions off that, Jay. One, why do you think he did that? And two, where is your relationship with him today? Because as you know, in television, you need your on-air people not to sell you out. It only works as if everybody is sort of fighting the same fight and being in sync and being collegial. It's very easy for one analyst to try to sell another analyst out if they're looking for more airtime, if they're looking to be smarter. So that to me, and I'm not trying to rip Doug here, but that to me seems a big case of Doug Gottlieb selling you out on the air.
Well, you know, I think it's just who Doug is. You know, I think Doug doesn't, you know, hold anything back. And first off, I'll say this. The dude is brilliant, right? I mean, he is a walking encyclopedia of what college basketball is and could talk about any sport and always has a different take that can, you know, he thinks outside the box and he's able to articulate that beautifully. I think one of the things that happened for us is that, you know, we were both young. I think my name carried some weight for what I was able to accomplish, even though I wasn't preparing the way I should have prepared. And I think Doug takes that competition personally. And, I think there were a lot of times where, you know, I would see Doug and I really wouldn't know what to say. And things were a little bit awkward between us. And he was always gracious about, you know, I think the one thing that's cool about Doug is that he would disagree with you and you have these fights on air. And then off air, he was still cool. He just went about going about doing his business. And personally, I didn't know how to take that, right? I didn't know how to decipher this relationship that you have with somebody on air compared to off air and how it could just go back to being somewhat decent or copacetic. So it was a painful experience. And there were a lot of things sometimes where I would find myself just looking for him to mess up, especially when I started to study the material day in and day out, like a little bit on a psychotic level, because I wanted to make sure that Doug Gottlieb is not going to screw me over again. So it made me prepare better, almost in a way he made me better. And I think now, you know, when I see him, I think towards the end of our relationship before he left for CBS, instead of, you know, hating coming into studio and being pissed off about, well, how is Doug going to shit on me today? It turned into one of these scenarios where it's like, oh, okay, like, yeah, let's go, Doug. Like, I look forward to this. Like, you might be my new Steve Blake. Like, I like this. Like, I want to battle you. Let's have some fun, because I think knowledge-wise, I knew what the hell I was talking about because I had started to prepare better. And so now if I see Doug, I have no problem disagreeing with him. I even like the fact that sometimes he likes to pick a fight. I could say something on Twitter and he'll just come out of nowhere and, you know, you're wrong. And I'm like, well, actually, you're wrong. So I can see how now we can make good TV, because I would never take anything personally. I just know that's who Doug Gottlieb is, and I actually embrace him, and I like it.
Interesting. I appreciate that that honesty. The book is really there's a lot of things in here, Jay, that I think people are going to be surprised to read. And you are very honest about cheating on your girlfriend in terms of the injury, wondering if you'll ever have sex again, your dependency on OxyContin, as you mentioned. You talk about suicide attempts and how that affected you and your parents. And when I was reading that, one of the things I wanted to ask you was, how did you weigh being honest in print versus being a public figure as a broadcaster? And it's not necessarily that I think people would be like angry at you for writing this, but I think it's something that we don't often see from broadcasters who are public people. So how did you weigh revealing some of the most intimate things in your life, knowing that you're a public face on a very big sports network?
I struggled with it for a long time. And actually, I owe a lot of credit to my agent, who's also like a brother to me, Evan Dick, over at CAA. You know, going through this process was brutal for me, Rich. I tried to start writing this thing myself and got pretty far into it. And then, you know, I'm very sensitive towards the emotions of people that I have around me. And, you know, am I completely open? Am I completely honest? Or do I want to, you know, keep certain things a secret? And, you know, I went back and forth writing it for, you know, 2 years, 2+ years, and worked with different editors, and maybe you should, you know, put it like this, maybe you should have it like that. And it got to the point where I started to, you know, entrust my, my board, right? I say, you know, everybody in life should have a board. You know, these big companies and these CEOs have boards that they need to answer to. And, you know, it's a round table of people that you trust that have the company's best interests. And, you know, you go to them for advice. And I started soliciting my board, and I sent it to Coach K, and I sent it to Evan, and I sent it to some other people. And I had everybody kind of tell me, like Coach K, he's always so great, man. He's very real, even though we don't always agree on things, but he said, you know, if I were a teacher, I would tell you to take your ass back home and make this paper better and hand it in when you are ready. And I remember being on the phone about a year ago, being like, oh, damn, okay, I just put 2.5 years of my energy and effort into this, and here it is, my coach telling me it's not good enough. So then, you know, sitting down with Evan and be like, all right, man, Evan's like, dude, no, stop. Like, let go. Like, stop holding back certain things. Like, it's time for you just to tell people how you really feel. Like, just let go. And as I started doing it, you know, when you're talking through the process, you're saying certain things where you're like, oh shit, like, I can't believe I'm saying all this. Like, I'm talking about, you know, how I picked up on women when I played, and, you know, how I had animosity towards Jalen Rose, and how I thought he was very much of a politician, even though he hated on me, and how delicate of a relationship I was. You know, I was trying to balance that with him, and, you know, how I didn't really like how my coach, Bill Cartwright, went about doing things, and how I was turning into a complete jerk off the court, and, you know, lost my passion for basketball, how quickly I became somebody different, right? And just, you know, getting up and going to Vegas and partying, or, you know, not caring and spending money gambling on planes with some of the guys, and, you know, my attempts at suicide. And then once I had diarrhea of the mouth for, you know, multiple hours, and I just started writing all this stuff out, I sat there holding the book in my hands and like, am I sure I want to say all this? And then I thought, you know, what makes me different than anybody else, man? There's nothing that makes me different. I'm just like everybody else. Everybody has their own shit that they go through in life. Everybody has their downs. Everybody's had some kind of accident, I guess. And that's who I am, you know, and I've been afraid to share that with everybody, because at Duke I was labeled the golden boy, and obviously you're trying to find out who the hell you are in this new job, and how can I make my way and hold the animosity for what I didn't accomplish in my past to get to where I am now. And I still have ways to go, but just to finally decide to let go.
Jay, what was the process of writing this book? Did you, like, I'm interested in the process itself. Did you pen a first draft and then work with editors on it? Did you have a writing collaborator who you would, the writing collaborator interviews you and then writes the book himself or herself? Can you, how did actually the book itself or the manuscript itself get done?
Oh God, it was the most painful experience of my life. I went through a series of people to write the book with, and you know, I started working with one guy. I won't say names just because I don't want to, you know, fully call anybody out. But I started working with one guy, and was writing it, and we were doing a ton of these transcriptions, and it was like my first time ever doing something like this. And the guy eventually wrote a blog, and was like, oh, I'm so tired of working with athletes who just don't share their full story. And, you know, prime example, I'm working with one now. I'm not going to say who he is, but he was, you know, he played for the Bulls, and he was a, you know, second pick in the draft, and it's just another.
That pretty much gives it away.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, oh, God, that's painful. So, the, you know, he went out the window, and then I started working with somebody else in Chicago, and he was going through a series of issues with his family, and he kind of disappeared, and started writing it myself, and then working with different editors, and it finally got down to the point where about, like, you know, 4 or 5 months before the book was about to come out, I sat down with Evan, and I'm like, what do you think? And he's like, I think this book is shitty. And I'm like, I would agree with you, and Coach K thinks it's shitty too. And he's like, let's write it. And we sat down, man, and just, we busted it out. Like, we just went through everything. We wrote it. And it was my voice more than it could ever be. And but it was the most arduous process I've ever been through, which I've never written a book before. You know, people are, when you see critiques, they're like, well, you know, Jay could be a better writer. I'm like, hell, like, I whatever I need to do, I'll work on it. But this thing took 3.5 years to get out. I'm glad it's finally done.
How did you go about talking to your employers about the book? The you know, as an employee of ESPN, you obviously want to give them the heads up of the content that's in the book. So how does that process go about? Who do you tell your immediate boss? Do you tell the head of college basketball? Does it get up to the John Skipper level? That's interesting to me. How do you let these guys know that the book, not only is the book coming out, but there's going to be things in this book that I think are going to surprise some people?
I sent the book to some of my immediate bosses, but I honestly didn't, you know, go through the process of being like, hey, you know, this is what I'm going to write. Is this okay? And I think I didn't do that because I went through that process with the people I cared about, and I got really frustrated at it, Rich. It was difficult because I felt like when I finally wrote it, you know, everybody has their take on, I don't feel comfortable with you saying this. I don't feel comfortable with you saying that. And I started to find myself trying to retract some of the things I was talking about. And I said, hold on, wait a second. Who am I writing this book for? You know, and am I writing this book? First off, it was a cathartic experience for me. And then, you know, secondly, am I writing this book to show people that I'm just like everybody else? Right? I have all these demons that I battle with on a day-to-day basis. And you know, how do I overcome these things? And I'm not better than anybody. You know, I'm average Joe too, trying to find my way. And who was lost for a long time, and almost developed a mentality where it was like, look, this is what it is. And I'm not going to change my story or lie about things for the sake of, you know, saving face. This is what I went through in order to get to where I'm at now. And I'm a lot better for it. But it is what it is. I'm not going to hide it. If I were to hide it and then somebody else were to tell it to the world, that would make me look like a coward, and I'm not.
I want to ask you, Jay, about broadcasting process. A lot of this podcast, when we interview writers or broadcasters, they talk about how they do what they do. So you have a number of different roles at ESPN, whether you're in the studio in Bristol or you're on a site, let's say, at College Game Day. I imagine also, obviously, you can even be a game analyst. So there are you have multiple ways that you get to the public in terms of your content. But let's start off with the studio. When you are, when you know that you're going to be on a show in Bristol for whatever day that is, how do you go about preparing for that show? When does that preparation start?
Well, I think it's very similar to how you prepare. It's something that you never just start. I think it's something that is a habit that you do every single day. So, and this is how I would have approached it, you know, 7 years ago. I would have been, you know, anxious and be like, oh my God, I have to go on First Take, or I have to, you know, do college basketball tonight. I gotta read about all these games. And I think when you go about preparing that way, it's almost, you know, you're trying to cram for a test, and it doesn't come across natural. It doesn't come across as authentic and real, right? Because I'm just spewing stats at you. And one of the things I've started to do as a broadcaster is I watch so many other people now, and I pay attention to how they deliver the news or how they deliver their content. Or, you know, I listen to your show and I see how you have conversations with people. And honestly, I find myself taking notes on things now and going over those notes and like, okay, I remember to do this or to do that. And I think as far as preparation, it comes with every day. I try to wake up in the morning, and something I really commend Carissa for too, you know, being with her for the past 4 years, the way she prepares for stuff, it's continuous. It's every day. You know, if I'm, you know, reading the New York Post this morning for, you know, 45 minutes to get my salacious news or to get different thoughts on different things, or, and then reading the New York Times and then reading articles online, and then, you know, reading about what happened yesterday in college basketball, even though I watched some of the games that SMU loses or that Providence and Villanova had this huge class in Philadelphia, you know, and getting different perspectives on that about, hey, you know, the NCAA, you know, the state can shut down, you know, certain aspects of transportation, but these kids are still playing, right? And people are still paying money to see these kids play on a crazy snow day. So it just comes with doing things every single day consistently. And so now when you're on air, I don't feel like I have to force something down. I can go with the flow of conversation because I'm equipped with this information that has just happened over time.
One of the things that you wrote about in your book was that you were really thankful that there were producers at ESPN, one in particular, Dan Steer, who's now at NBC, who really believed in you, took a shot at you. But it seemed like all the producers had much of the same feedback for you, and that was slow down, like slow your broadcasting down. So how did you go about doing that? How does one like literally take that advice, slow down, and then indeed slow down?
Well, being from New Jersey, there's a habit to speak fast 24/7. And I guess, you know, us from Jersey, we're like salesmen. We're always trying to, you know, tell you why. And, you know, working with Dan Steer, who was just tremendous, it was painful, man. You know, getting these calls, and, you know, as soon as I would see that, you know, that area code pop up my phone, I knew it was Dan. And, you know, just when you would pick up the phone, you're like, hey, Dan. He's like, hey, Jason. You're like, how's your day going, Dan? And if I was speaking in public, people would look at me like I was psychotic. I'd go, what's wrong with you? Why are you speaking so slow? And the worst experience was actually getting, you know, DVDs from Dan and, you know, popping the DVD in and hearing yourself, like closing your eyes and hearing yourself. And then going back and like, what the hell did I just say? Like, God, that sounded horrible. So just trying to work on that every single day and, you know, put that into how I communicate with people on the street, you know, how I talk to my mom, how I talk on the phone, and just trying to incorporate that into my daily habits. And, you know, ESPN has been great. They got me working with a broadcasting coach. I've worked with multiple broadcasting coaches, one who had a couple of things that people do over at ESPN, where they, you know, you put two fingers in your mouth, and he had me kind of put the two fingers in my mouth and kind of hold down my tongue and do a series of all these sounds. And it was like, Richard, it was so embarrassing. I'm doing this sound in front of all these people. Imagine having two fingers in your mouth, like your index finger and your middle finger, and you're holding down your tongue and you're making this, this hand sound. You're like, why the hell am I doing this? And, you know, like Coachman, who is a host on SportsCenter, he still does it every day to warm up. And you just hear this annoying ha sound. And it's to, you know, it's to warm your voice up, you know, to get your voice prepared to speak on TV. And I'm sitting here saying, who am I, Anchorman? What am I doing? Al Now, Brown Cow? Like, what, right. What the heck's all this stuff? But, you know, there was a process to, I guess, warming up your vocal cords and not being embarrassed by doing so. So it's been weird, but it's been cool and different.
Right. The arsonist has oddly shaped feet. I think that's
exactly.
I think that's you one of the things in the book, obviously, that gets a lot of pages and a lot of thought is your accident. And, you know, there's going to be other interviews that you're going to do, which are going to focus on your career, Jay. This is obviously much more media centric. But I do wonder, are you now at 34 years old? Have you gotten to a place where you have forgiven yourself for the accident? Because it struck me in reading the book that so much of the books and your own, so much of your own journey from that day until today was about sort of letting go of who you were, or whatever identity you thought you had then, and have now forged into a new identity, and if you sort of extend it into a new man. So have you let go of whatever the accident represented in terms of this hypothetical place where your career or life may have been? I probably could ask that better, but I'm trying to get to the core of, have you allowed yourself to forgive you for going on that bike as a 21-year-old?
I have forgiven myself, but I haven't forgot. And I don't think I will ever forget, nor do I want to forget, because I think that that accident still serves into my motivation to this day, right? So prime example, when I watch guys play on TV, like when I watch a Derrick Rose, right? Or, you know, you still see, you know, these guys get these massive contracts, or the inflation of, you know, the contracts with the CBA now for the NBA. And you sit there and there are times where I'll be at home watching a game and, you know, somebody will send me a tweet and say, man, you were Derrick Rose before Derrick Rose. And I'm not going to, you know, lie. Like, you know, the thought still goes right through my mind where I said, damn, I want to make, I got $150 million, $200 million.
Right.
And as soon as I have that thought, I go to the internet. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to read an article. Like, I'm going to read an article about what happened today. So it fuels my motivation in being better at my craft. And like, that's what drives me, man. It's, whenever somebody throws my accident in my face now, if they disagree with something I say on air, or if they're just looking for a way to hurt me, or just, you know, one of these bullies behind a keyboard, I use it as a positive thing. And, you know, I joke about it now. Before, you know, I would allow it to send me into a downward spiral where I would become even more depressed. I would drink more. I would pop an OxyContin. I wouldn't want to talk. I would become so small. Whereas now, you know, I joke around, like, you know, a couple of years ago at the Final Four, I took a picture. There was a Harley Davidson outside, and I took a picture on it. And I said, oh, man, I'm running late for my next TV interview. I'll be there soon. And people are like, don't do it. Don't do it. And, like, I'm just like, no, I don't care. You know, I'll go into, you know, a media day for, you know, one of these college game day sites, and I'll carry a helmet in. I'm like, I'm sorry, guys. I'm a little bit late. Traffic was a little bit crazy. So, yeah, I'm all about being self-deprecating about it now. And I don't mind it, because it doesn't define me, but it's also a part of my journey. And it just inspires me to be better at what I do now and to be a better man overall.
Jay, do you have any recollection of how ESPN commentators talked about you after the accident, or even a couple of years after the accident? It's interesting to me now that you're now in a position where if there was a 21-year-old college, let's say Ben Simmons, God forbid, jumps on a bike tomorrow and gets hurt. So you would be one of the people at ESPN prominently talking about that. But I wonder, do you recall how you were covered at ESPN, and did they cover you, in your opinion, objectively, fairly, with some smarts, or were they, I don't know, were they first taking it up and calling you a fool for as a 21-year-old blowing your career by going on the bike?
Well, at first it was more of this, we hope he's okay, you know, and more of reporting the accident. Now, I didn't watch as many shows being stuck in the hospital for a very long time, but I got a ton of newspaper clips and, you know, letters from across the world from people checking in on me, some fans who were angry at me as well from being Bulls fans and saying, you know, I can't believe you're a wasted draft pick. And here I am on my back knowing if I'm never going to be able to walk again was a pretty, you know, humbling process of going through. And it was, of course, I didn't like it at the time. I was pissed off at everybody. Even more so, I was pissed off at myself. More, I was pissed off at everybody else. But there's a evolution of how I feel about broadcasters or media personalities now compared to how I felt about it when I was 21. When you're 21, you're against the world, right? And there's a tendency for all of these athletes, you don't really focus on the positive things that people say when things are going great. You really hold it against people that write anything negative about you, right? Because that's what fuels you, right? Negativity, it drives you. So I didn't try to watch ESPN because I didn't want to hear what people were saying about me. I already knew what they were saying. You know, he's an idiot for throwing away his career. You know, there goes the Bulls' wasted draft pick, or fans being like, I can't believe we wasted our number two pick on you, you moron. You know, just go hit another tree. You know, people were saying crazy stuff, and I don't know how I would have handled it if I were to have that accident in this era with the access that we have to news feeds with Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, all that stuff, or just the variety of ways that people can report news now. I might have completed that task of suicide. I went on my third attempt. So I think by trying to not paying attention to it, but it was still being brought to my attention, was one of the most difficult things that I ever had to go through. And it's something that I lived with for, you know, 10 years, 10 plus years. And I think that's what kind of numbed the pain of when I went on OxyContin, right? I found this drug that numbed what people said to me because I was lost in my own head, right? So I can have a conversation with somebody that was angry with me about, you know, ruining the Bulls franchise and, you know, being like, yeah, you're right, I did ruin it. And I would apologize to that person, like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that, whatever. And, you know, then go about my way and just like, whatever, like, yeah, I fucked that one up, you know, and just live my life because I was high all the time, right? So I couldn't really feel it. I couldn't really embrace it. And that's what doing drugs did for me. It kind of kept me away from the pain.
And as you write in the book, you basically, you got off that cold turkey, right? You went through all the withdrawal. That's kind of crazy to me that you didn't do it through a doctor's care. You basically stopped, and you must have had, I don't know what the withdrawal is like, but I can imagine it must have been 2 or 3 or 4 weeks of not sleeping, the shakes, and just hell, basically, on earth.
I mean, I literally locked myself in my room, and I was living in the Lower East Side. I was living with four guys, right? Think about go from, you know, being in Chicago and having this crazy apartment and living your dreams to, you know, living with three of your friends in the Lower East Side who are all bartenders and who are partying all the time, and the dishes are all loaded up in the sink, and there's food on the ground, and the place smells like beer, and it's constant partying. Like, I locked myself in my room, and it was painful, man. And I refused to come out. And it was something that it got to a breaking point for me that night. I explained it in my book where, you know, I tried to end my life for the second time. I was drinking all the time, man. I was gaining weight, and I was still trying to find my way working within the industry, trying to be, you know, work for an agency, and a guy I really respected. And just people were taking shots at me left and right. You know, why would you want to sign up this agency? How is Jay a good representation for them? You know, he threw away his whole career. And, you know, then the whole Kevin Love situation, that article just broke me, where I truly wanted to jump on a plane and have a bat and just bash Kevin Love's legs in. But, you know, I had done that to myself, right? And I tried to put myself in his situation years later. I'm like, well, you know, okay, like if I was a kid, I may not have used his words that he used, but I would have, you know, backtracked too and try to, you know, save my own ass. So, yeah, it was a hard experience, but it was one that I'm the kind of guy where if I put my mind to something, I'm going to do it. And that's what I had to do in order to pull myself out of the biggest funk I've ever been in.
And the Kevin Love reference, you guys can check out Jay's book for that in terms of his interaction with Kevin Love when Kevin was in college and Jay working for an agency. Also, it's probably a Google search away as well, but definitely worth checking out. Just the intersection, obviously, of a guy who's in the league today and obviously on a very prominent team. All right, our guest is Jay Williams, the ESPN college basketball analyst. We appreciate him being on today. Got a couple more questions for him. Jay, actually, as I look back at the draft that you were in, it's pretty interesting to actually now think about the guys who were part of that draft, the ones who obviously were really successful and not as successful. Yao Ming at the top of the draft. Mike Dunleavy was right behind you. Drew Gooden. Nene was in that draft. Amari Stoudemire went ninth, which is pretty interesting as I look back on it. Tayshaun Prince, Carlos Boozer way down the list. Matt Barnes at 46. But then there were some other guys. You know, DeJuan Wagner didn't really last in the league long, and he was sixth in that draft. Chris Wilcox was eighth. Jared Jeffries, Melvin Eli, Marcus Houseslip, Fred Jones. There, it's kind of a weird, interesting draft because there were a lot of guys who made it, but then maybe half that draft in the first round didn't really have long NBA careers.
Yeah, I don't know if that draft class really panned out as people expected it to be. Obviously, the next year was the crazy year,
right,
with the big ballers coming in. But it's really interesting, you know, when I watched Dunleavy, and I know he went through, you know, having surgery, but still with the Bulls, I'm like, wow, man, Dunleavy's 14 plus years in the league, and, you know, or Drew or Nene, and these guys are still effective to some degree. And I think about, you know, DeJuan, obviously. You know, if you watched DeJuan Wagner play back in high school, that dude was
incredible. Camden, right? He was like the top player in the country.
He was unbelievable. And, you know, DeJuan introduced me to World Wide West and that whole world. And, you know, that I was like, wow, okay. Like, DeJuan was doing it for Cleveland. And him and Booz were on the same team for the Cavs when they were being coached by John Lucas. And then obviously for, you know, I don't know if it was his gallbladder or his kidney that he had all those issues with. And
right. He
can never really pan out. So, yeah, it was – I think it's something that, you know, whenever I see these guys, you know, we obviously I think, you know, whenever an article comes out and they talk about the biggest draft bust, I'm usually on that article. And when I sit there and I go through the list, I'm like, well, damn, like we all kind of didn't really find a way as much as we hoped we would have back when we were getting drafted. But, you know, that's how the league works out. You know, if you're the guy one moment, and then if you're not, I mean, Derrick Rose is still, you know, starting to find his way right now, but look how quickly, you know, people started to replace him with Jimmy Butler. You know, Jimmy Butler becomes the face of the Bulls franchise now. You're still wondering, you know, about Derrick Rose. Will he ever be himself again? Now, granted, he didn't have a motorcycle accident, but there's always this influx of new talent that comes in, and that's how quickly you can be forgotten.
Yeah, and so you make a really good point, and obviously DeJuan Wagner played at Memphis for a year, and we should point out, or I'll point out as I'm looking at this, obviously, had injuries and health problems, including colonitis, so there were some injuries there. Mm-hmm. But as Jay said, that guy, just from growing up here in New York, like, or living here in New York at the time, at Camden High School, that guy was incredible. I mean, he really was, like,
he's scoring like 70 points a game.
Yeah, he was basically killing people, like, left and right. And he probably is, and Jay, you may agree or disagree, he may be considered the best player ever to come out of New Jersey, at least as a high schooler. He's got to be up there.
For me, I think he would have to be up there. I went to a game because I was the same class, and, you know, I was a late bloomer. So people were like, well, you know, Jay, you know, you're really good, but you're not like this kid, DeJuan Wagner. And me being a competitive, crazy person I am, I'm like, you know, I'm going to go check this kid out. So I remember one of my friends and I, a guy named Brian Wilson, who played at Holy Cross, we jumped in the car and we drove down to Camden to see a game. I forget who they were playing, but he had like 65 points. And it was the first time in my life where I walked out of a gym, I was like, Yeah, respect. Yeah, I'm not like that. I can't do that stuff. Like, that's unbelievable. Like, the kid was shooting every time, and just not shooting, but making every shot. He's one of the most prolific scorers I've ever seen.
All right, one more topic, Jay, before we get to Carissa Thompson, who was a guest on this podcast and incredibly honest and one of my favorite podcast guests. And you two, obviously, there's an interaction or an intersection with you two, and we'll get to that. But I did want to ask you one thing about – you know, a couple of years ago, you made comments about when you were in the league, NBA players smoking marijuana before games. And that was interesting to me, just in the sense that the reaction, forget about you saying it, and I certainly believe you were being honest, but the reaction was so interesting to me that it seemed like there were so many people angry at you for, I guess I'd say, for lack of a better phrase, like breaking the code. What was your reaction to the actual reaction of that?
I laughed at it because, first off, look, our country is becoming a lot more progressive in that category anyway with smoking marijuana. And the funny thing is, and, you know, you talk about being a politician, you know, I was reading Jalen Rose's book, you know, you got to give the people what they want. And
right.
I was reading the excerpt when he was talking about me, and he was like, you know, Jason was lost, and obviously, you know, on the Bulls team. And look, there were a lot of issues that Jalen and I had, you know, a couple, number one being, you know, we won my first game in the Bulls uniform, and, you know, I missed a couple of free throws down the stretch. And, you know, he said out at the end and post game that I had choked and that I need to get better. I'm like, wow, okay. Like, that's interesting to read the next morning when you're at home after you just won a game where your teammate says that you choked. So that kind of started that whole thing off. But in the book, you know, he's like, you know, Jay was just lost, and no, guys were smoking weed. Guys didn't do that. We were professional. And I'm like, there goes Jalen being the politician again. And the only reason I know that is because I didn't smoke before games, but I'd smoke with the guys throughout the course of the year, right? I'm not going to sit here and say I didn't. And I was trying to save that for my book to show that I was just as much of the problem as they were. But look, I'm actually
and the weird thing, I'm really not against it. And maybe not before a game, but if that's, you know, taking a pill that has cannabis oil, I also see the other effects of it, Rich, in taking, you know, ibuprofen 800 four times a day,
right?
Or getting addicted to Oxycontin or taking a Percocet. These are all things that they prescribe with no problem.
Right. Dulling for medicinal reasons, dulling pain or helping you with pain, et cetera.
Exactly. And, you know, people say all the time, you know, why would you do that? Well, let me tell you, if I want to play each and every night, if I'm a point guard in the league now and it's a Monday and we're playing against the Knicks, you're like, okay, like I may have to go against Jerry and Grant, whatever. And then, you know, Tuesday you go and you play against Portland. Well, now I'm going against Dame Lillard. Okay, well, Wednesday we have off, but we practice, right? Maybe I tweak my ankle on that Monday night against Jerry and Grant. That's going to play into that game Tuesday against Damian. That's going to play into practice on Wednesday. That's going to play into Thursday when I have to go against Russell Westbrook. That's going to play into Friday when I have to go against Stephen Curry. I mean, we have off Saturday. It's going to play into Sunday when I have to go against Kyrie Irving. I don't have an off night, right? So do I want to become addicted to painkillers, or do I want to take a hit of marijuana when I'm at home relaxing that actually reduces the inflammation more than an ibuprofen could? So I'm not against that, but, you know, for people saying I was selling teammates out, I'm like, no, this is a lot more common than the regular day fan thinks. I mean, drinking alcohol is something that guys do. I mean, I've never seen this. Obviously, coming from Duke, I came from Camelot, okay? I get that. You know, Coach K was King Arthur. We had a Knights at a Round Table. That's how he ran his program. But when I came off a game with the Bulls back then, I would see guys, you know, go through a 12-pack on the plane. They'll get drunk off drinking Corona or having whatever drink they were having. So I'm like, well, like, what's more detrimental to the body? You know, being a drunk, that's allowed, but I can't take a hit of marijuana to calm down and relax or reduce my anxiety. So, yeah, I was shocked by that. But at the same time, I also understand that people don't understand how some of these guys live their lives. And they're going to try to crucify me for being honest. But that's just the way it is. And that's the way it is in a lot of professional sports. It's not basketball.
Could guys, after drinking, let's say, a 12-pack, I mean, is it just because they're 23, they can then basically sleep it off the next day, and then by tip at 7 o'clock they can play? Or did you see even on the court some guys just the after effects of that kind of like partying the night before, they just weren't at 100%?
Yeah, I mean, look, I had partied in college and I wasn't 100% for a lot of games. Okay, I mean, I came into my own, and you know, things you do when you're 18, 19, but I mean, guys who were even in their 30s would hang out and party like that. It was one of those things that when you're young or when you're making that amount of money, you find ways of justifying your actions, right? Well, we just lost this game by 30. I don't really care anymore. It's cool. You know, our next game's tomorrow at 7 o'clock. I can, you know, go through, you know, shoot around and still be somewhat tipsy from the night before, and the coaches aren't going to really notice. And, you know, I could sleep it off, and then when the game comes, I could play my game, you know, and you still try to be competitive. But it's just the way the world works, especially when you're on a bad team and, you know, the average age of your team is 24 years old and your leader is still a guy. Like, you know, Jalen was not in a great space, and I think he would admit to that as well. Like, he was not supposed to be traded from Indiana, right? Like, he got into a whole ton of beef with Isaiah Thomas because Isaiah and Donnie Walsh had promised for him to stay, and, you know, they obviously went against those, you know, those promises and decided to trade him. And goes from being a guy in Indiana to being a guy on a team with a lot of young players.
Right.
And, you know, and then also being coached by Bill Cartwright, who had no head coaching experience. So, you know, that was our team. And it was a team that had fun and did things that they shouldn't have been doing. But that's what happens when you have a young basketball team.
All right. We will finish up. But I think the whole lesson of this, Jay, isn't it to be a stretch forward in the NBA instead of a point guard? It's just too tough to be a point guard.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. As I mentioned before, Carissa Thompson was a guest on this podcast a couple months ago, and she talked very candidly about dating you, what it was like to date someone within your profession, and what it was like to have an interracial public relationship in the era of social media. So I think you knew that I'd ask you about this because it's a very interesting topic. First and foremost, are you still currently dating, or would you classify yourself just as friends now, just for context?
No, Carissa and I are together.
Okay.
And it's been a process for us. not only dealing with things publicly. It's been a process for her. You know, she was very open on your show about going through a divorce. And
yep.
I think there were a lot of things that she needed to work through in that regard. And there are a lot of things that I needed to work on. You know, Carissa was really like my first adult relationship. I mean, I had been with a couple of girls, you know, from that point on, but not to the level that Carissa and I were. Like, I love that girl and am in love with that girl. So, it was difficult for us, her coming out of some of the stuff and, you know, me still trying to find my way in the industry and not feeling jealous with what other guys say to her, not only online, but she's in that world where she's surrounded by pro athletes who make a lot of money. And that's something that I kind of threw away, right? Like, I made my accident. So my ego took some blows in trying to deal with that and some of the guys that were courting her. And it's been a process for us, but it's been one I think we're a lot better for now.
How do you, Jay, how do you approach, and maybe it's a little bit easier because you work for different networks, but how do you, and I asked Carissa this, how do you approach dating someone within the same industry? Essentially, you guys have different roles. She's a host and she has her extra job and she does the NFL. You obviously do college basketball, but essentially you're both sports presenters on television. So how is it for you to date somebody who's within the same profession?
I think at first it was really difficult, and I found myself being, you know, competitive sometimes with some of the things that she was able to do, right? So it's, you know, one of my goals is to be a host as well. I hope one day I could get there, and, you know, obviously I have a guy like Strahan who's a prime example of how you can do that. And, you know, dealing with some of the things she was going through, right? I know one of the most difficult things we had to deal with at the beginning for the first couple of years was that, you know, she was a lot more attractive to the public if she were single.
Right.
And, you know, you had agents tell her that, you had publicists tell her that, you had people in her camp tell her that. And for me, it was frustrating, right? Because here I am, you know, being with her and, you know, her still having to say, well, you know, I'm single, I'm still trying to figure it out and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, well, wait a second, like, what am I doing over here? You know, but obviously it was a sensitive issue because of her ex-husband and, you know, the emotions that he had. And so I think that was challenging. And then also, you know, work-wise, she was in positions with, you know, guys who had a lot of money and who had a lot of success and fame, right? And I think there were a lot of times earlier on where, look, when it's out there that you're single and you're surrounded by rich, successful guys, what, you tell me a man who isn't going to be somewhat insecure, right? To a certain degree about, like, you know, and obviously our trust is something that had to be built over time, but it was, you know, Carissa also has a little bit of a wild child in her, which I like, you know, she's, you know, she'll hang out with the guys and kick it and, you know, have a couple of drinks and be relaxed. And she's like that. And, you just have to, I had to learn who Carissa is and how she handles herself and learn how to trust her in those moments. But that took time, man. That was difficult for us.
And that's interesting. You brought up something really interesting to me just because how agents and executives and producers would want to position someone like Carissa to be on the air single, because that, let's face it, you can sort of sell that to a mostly male audience. Or if actually on the entertainment side, you could certainly sell that to single females who may be watching Extra. That's probably a little bit different than males in sports, who maybe ESPN wants to sell somebody as a family dude, even if that person is indeed not a family dude. That's you know, you could sort of sell that to the public. So I appreciate you saying that. That's very interesting. The thing obviously I asked Carissa about, and she really got a lot of this on Twitter, and I wonder what it was like for you, is to be dating someone who's of a different race. And Carissa told me on the podcast that, I mean, she would be called some ridiculous slang like mud shark, which essentially, I guess, is a white girl dating a black guy. What was it like for you on the other end? I bet you it was probably worse for her, but I guarantee you probably faced some of that too.
I get it all the time. You know, I kind of lived that life for a while when I was playing, where people would, you know, criticize or scrutinize every single thing I did. So I was used to it. I kind of stopped caring about what people thought. But I knew it was going to be different for her because she had never been with somebody who was an African-American before, like openly, publicly. So
I knew it was going to be somewhat of a challenge for her because, you know, which is really funny because people are like, oh, all you do is date black guys. And Chris is like, actually, no, Jay's the first African-American guy I've ever dated. People love to put you in a box. For me, earlier on, I got it a lot more from African-American women who felt like I was a sellout, or, you know, from, you know, African-American guys who would be like, oh, you're an Uncle Tom because of where I went to school at, or because I would, you know, speak properly or whatever it is. And, you know, that really bothered me at first. And I was like, well, hold on a second. You know, I've dated everybody from Hispanic to, you know, black to white to Asian. Like, I really don't look, that's not the first thing I look at when I talk to somebody. I'm not like, well, okay, well, she's African-American, so that means, you know, I have to make this work. I'm like, well, is she smart? Does she make me laugh? Is she personable? Like, is she nice to other people? Like, those are the things that attract me to a person. Now, I still respect, you know, a lot of my friends are Jewish and how they feel like, you know, they want to, you know, keep that whole thing going on. And I understand that. That's their prerogative, whatever they want to do. I don't live my life that way. But I think for Carissa, it was difficult, you know, people just hating on her all the time because of who she's with. And it goes, I told her, you know, she's from Seattle. I don't think she's really seen it as much as there's still a lot of racism that goes on in this world. And you have a lot of these bullies who are behind these screens that were just like, oh yeah, you're only with black dudes. And Chris is like, oh no, it's not that way at all. And it was a challenge for her. And I think now she doesn't really care, even though sometimes it still might hurt. I mean, how can it not? But I think she's a little bit over it, as she would say.
How do you, how have you managed the idea of working for competing networks? Do you basically just anything that's said about the other network stays within the relationship, or do you try to avoid actively talking too much about what's going on at the other place because there are, because, you know, in the end, you do work for competing entities.
Well, we do work for competing entities, but we're also a team. We're our own team. And I think that, you know, look, she's great because she gives me advice on how I could be better at my job and some of the answers she looks for from a host. And, you know, here are certain things you can work on when you want to become a host. And I think I help her in how she can debate some things, right? She's never really had to debate and how to take certain positions on issues. So I think we have a very open relationship. You know, we talk about both of our industries and our companies have things that we need to work on. And, you know, we understand that, look, this is something that stays between us, and we solicit each other's advice. And look, she's been doing this for a long time. I would be remiss if I didn't ask her for her advice on certain things. And, you know, I can give her, you know, my angle on situations as well. And we work as a team.
Yeah. I mean, she really has, over the last couple of years, I think really found herself as a host and becoming really versatile in sports. She can do sideline reporting. And then obviously with the extra stuff, I think she's positioning herself for a lot of potential things, although I think it's very competitive in terms of what she does. As you know, Jay, broadcasting is competitive in itself. And then broadcasting in Los Angeles when you want to be a hybrid sports celebrity person is pretty tough. But
I would be shocked, Rage, like in 5 years, if I don't see her on the Today Show or GMA. I mean, I think that she is. And the one thing I love about Carissa is that she loves to work, right? She loves the grind and she studies her trait. So, you know, I know that for the end game, that's where she would love to be. And she's in California right now. I'm in New York. So she's like, hey, I'm going to work and do everything I can do to get reps. And, you know, I hope and pray that it works out for her because she's really good at what she does.
You know, we'll let your CAA agents, Jay, tell her to, like, let's make that happen for her, all right?
Stop. Oh, we're putting out there. This is our first step in putting it out there.
Right. Stop focusing on other clients and make it happen for Carissa. All right. We will we'll finish up with it. First of all, Jay, one of the other things that's interesting, you don't have to get into this on this podcast, but I think people should, when they're reading the book, pay attention to the fact that Jay, by the way, once went on a double date with Serena Williams, correct?
I did, which was quite the experience, her and Salita Ebanks, Carissa always jokes with me about, like, oh, Jay, we know, we dated a model, Jesus. It was one of those really weird scenarios where, you know, Salita and I met randomly on vacation with my mom. Hooked us up out of all people.
Wow.
Like, oh, my mom with the unbelievable bounce pass. I can't believe this is happening.
That's Bob Cousy-esque with that assist. Good job.
Exactly, right? The look-away pass. So, you know, we started dating or whatever, and not really publicly, but, you know, for me, I'm still a little bit lost at the time trying to figure out what the hell is going on with work and who I'm going to be. And, you know, she's like, oh, yeah, I have this friend coming in town, you know, we should all go out. And I'm like, all right, to my friend. And I'm like, it shouldn't be hard for me to sell my friend on, you know, Victoria's Secret model telling me that she has a friend coming in town and let's go on a double date. And, you know, that friend turned out to be Serena Williams. And Serena is such a sweetheart. And that night was one of those epic nights that you'll just never forget.
Right.
How about that? We'll leave it at that. It was just one of those nights where you're like, really, really, this shit is happening right now of all the nights. This has to happen on this night. And it was really funny, man. It was great.
Yeah, we'll save that. Save that for the book if you want to buy it. It's a pretty good anecdote. And I remember when I was reading the book, I was like, wow, holy shit, that's kind of an interesting like little night that Jay had there with Serena Williams. And as we now see today, Serena Williams in the Australian Open rolling on, arguably the greatest women's athlete of all time. All right, Jay, I want to leave you with this. Last question, and again, I appreciate your honesty on Carissa in particular. Both of you guys are very honest about this. You don't have to talk about this publicly, but I appreciate it. And I think people, there's a lot of young broadcasters who listen to this podcast, so, and they're going to, in the work environment, end up dating sometimes people they work with. So I think it's important to hear how two very high-profile people do it. Finally, in terms of Mike Krzyzewski, Jay, there's going to be a time when he steps away from Duke, and undoubtedly, every time he is on the air, whether it's a CBS or an ESPN, I guarantee there are producers behind the scenes who would do anything to get this guy in a full-time broadcasting situation. He obviously works for Sirius. He has his Coach K show for a long time. But whenever Mike steps down from basketball, do you see him transitioning to this world at all, or do you think he would do something outside of basketball? I'm sorry, outside of broadcasting.
I don't know if he would go into basketball. I think his commentary would be off the charts. Obviously, the way he sees the game and thinks about the game is unprecedented. But I think Coach K has done so well for himself that I think he would stay around the program. I think he would serve in some kind of capacity or some role with Duke basketball, which is going to be a little bit intimidating for the next head coach at Duke.
Right.
But I still see him being involved in USA basketball. I don't know if I see him doing this grind as much as I see him doing something on a higher level from a managerial perspective. Just because I think he's always going to want to stay close and attached to the game. But he's not one of those guys that yearns for visibility. He's going to take advantage of whatever situation is in front of him, obviously, and he's going to use USA basketball and his visibility, you know, for his advantage, obviously, in recruiting and, you know, expanding the Duke brand internationally. But I don't know if I see him broadcasting. I think, you know, when it's all said and done, he'll spend a lot more time with Mickey. He'll spend a lot more time, that's his wife, a lot more time with his kids and his grandkids. And he's a very private person, which also made this book a little bit difficult to write because, you know, I'm like, hey, everybody, Coach K does curse, and it's okay. you know, he's an unbelievable motivator, but he does have a little bit of that Bob Knight in him, even though he's extremely different than Bob Knight and his ways to motivate you. And he's human too. But I see him being a lot more of a private person with his family and doing that more so than I see him coming on the broadcasting side.
Yeah, and if you check out Jay's book, really very poignant scene of Mike Krzyzewski coming to Jay's hospital bed and basically convincing him that he's going to play again. All right, Jay, last one. This is really the last one. You're the GM of a team. I throw every single player in the NBA available into a draft. Do you take Steph Curry or LeBron James first, and why?
For where the league is going right now, I take Steph Curry.
Wow.
And I love LeBron, but there's something to be said about, I got a chance to spend some time with him, and I've spent some time with LeBron too at D-Wade's fantasy camp. And look, LeBron is one of the best players we've ever seen. I think Steph is going to be in that category too when it's all said and done. But I'm biased, Rich. Like, watching this kid, like, not only is he one of the most prolific scorers I've ever seen, but it's the way he goes about doing it, right? Like, and there's doing TV now. Like, I like players who are able to entertain me. And, like, watching Steph when he shoots a three, the fact that he can shoot the ball and then turn around
and give Andre Iguodala like, you know, two fives and a slap, whatever it is, before the ball is even going in the hole, because his confidence level is that high. I love stuff like that, right? I love this careless attitude. You know, ESPN did this great thing where this guy who does all these great impersonations of Ray Lewis did this whole thing where he said, you know, LeBron, you know, paid him to do this video about how to stop Stephen Curry. And he's like, Stephen Curry is like that little kid you see in the locker room who's sitting Indian style, like eating chicken nuggets, right? Like that's really like who he is at his heart. And I just love that careless attitude. And I love that style in which he plays. And I think the NBA is transitioning more so to that small ball mentality, which is why you're seeing Cleveland, you know, struggle. You saw him struggle against the Bulls. You saw him struggle against San Antonio when they go small, and you're seeing him struggle against Golden State.
All right, the guest has been Jay Williams, the ESPN college basketball analyst. His book, out, is it out now, Jay, or is it coming out this week?
It comes out tomorrow.
Comes out tomorrow,
a day after the crazy snowstorm in New York.
All right, and we're taping this January 25th, so it comes out January 26th. The book is Life is Not an Accident, a memoir of reinvention, and this is Jay's story from being a Duke All-American, number two pick in the NBA draft, and his journey to now being a broadcaster at ESPN and all that's come with it. Listen, Jay, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this today. I really enjoyed the conversation, and continued success and best of luck with all facets of what you're doing, including your relationship with Carissa. We like you both, so I hope that works out.
Thanks so much, man. I really appreciate the time.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.